And it is 9 a.m. in the West Coast. It is 12 noon in the East Coast. It is 7 p.m. in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Today is December 12, 2016, and this is Orly Benny Davis with the Impossible Truth. Today on BBS Radio, we are going to start incredible, incredible news, because as we speak, on the way to Israel right now, we have two of those humongous, incredible jet fighters, F-35, that they are about to touch base in Israel at around 7:30 local PM local time. And they are a game changer in the region, and I'm sure that everybody is going to be excited about that. Since the events of the recent days make sure that we need to have the most incredible defense mechanism that Israel can have. And the USA was graceful enough to promote and produce those incredible Lockheed Martin planes that will change completely the game in the Middle East. Because, you know, what we have right now in the Middle East is not an easy task for the new elected president. Donald Trump, of course, is a very smart guy, and not touching base with the intelligence every morning may be something he would like to do. But I would recommend everybody to think again when you talk about information. Information is something that change and can vary it from 1 second to another. And any points in the reference is important to see the picture. So more information you get, more you're alert. More information you get, more you see the pattern. More pattern you see, you can save the day, guys. So this F-35, guys, I'm sure they can save the day. Of course, high expectation everybody have, and we know that we have a lot of things to fix there. But trust the equipage here in Israel to do their best to make it incredible. And I trust them, and I trust the Israeli Air Force bases that they will implement them beautifully. Now, we have some comments about what's going on, because in Syria, of course, you know that Assad is gaining control right now, and there is a little balance that we need to keep. Let's listen to what the president-elect Donald Trump had to say about that.
Syria may be off the front pages, but the situation there is
terrible.
It's awful. Dire, yeah. We have the Defense Secretary Ash Carter in Brussels convening leaders there tomorrow, including Arab states, asking them to do more. They say that we need more U.S. leadership, that we should commit U.S. ground troops. Should we commit U.S. ground troops?
Well, you know, Syria is a whole different thing. And you look at what's happening. I view ISIS as very important. And I love the fact that Russia is hitting ISIS. And as far as I'm concerned, they've got to continue to hit
ISIS. But you know what Russia is doing in Syria? Russia is hitting,
hitting
the groups that we're backing.
Sure. And why are we backing the group? We don't even know who those people are. I speak to generals. They're saying we're giving billions of dollars of equipment to people we have no. Here we go again. Mm. We're giving all of this money and all of this equipment to people we have no idea who they are. They're probably worse than Assad. I mean, Assad's no baby. He's not good. But who are the people that we're backing? Here we go again with Libya.
That's President Obama's argument.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's good.
Who the weapons would fall into whose hands.
We have no idea. Well, why is he doing that? I mean, he's giving them a lot of weaponry, and we're backing people that want to knock out Assad. Russia and Iran, which is now a power, we've made them a power, they're backing Assad. We've got to get rid of ISIS. We've got to get rid of the people that are chopping off everybody's head.
You say you have a good relationship with Putin, or would have a good relationship?
I think I would have a very good relationship, but who knows?
So could you convince Putin to get Assad to step aside?
Well, they've been trying to do that. Yeah. Could I? I don't think it's that important, to be honest with you. I think, frankly, let's say you get rid of Assad or you knock out that government. Who's going to take over? The people that were backing, and then you're going to have, like, Libya, right? You take Gaddafi. Oh, we have to get rid of Gaddafi. Look what happened after we got rid of Gaddafi. Look what happened after we got rid of
Gaddafi.
So getting
rid of Gaddafi was a mistake.
It was just, it was a total mistake. I mean, Benghazi was the least. Look at what's going on over there. It's a mess. Nobody knows anything about anything. You look at Saddam Hussein. We get rid of Saddam Hussein, the terrorists, it's the Harvard
of terrorism. So getting rid of Gaddafi and getting rid of Saddam Hussein were both mistakes.
Had we not done anything, had our politicians gone to the beach and enjoyed the sun, we would be in a lot better position than we are right now. Saddam Hussein, no good guy, but Saddam Hussein killed terrorists. Now Iraq is the Harvard of terror. You want to become a terrorist, go to Iraq. They'll teach you how, okay? Mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. But, you know, one other thing he did, he blocked Iran. I mean, once you knocked out that section, all of us, and I said it in 2003, 2004, I was against the war. I said, you're going to have the Middle East is going to be a mess. They used to fight forever. They couldn't move. They go 10 feet one way, 10 feet the other. Now you have a total destabilization in the Middle East because we knocked out one of the blocks.
What's the difference in your appeal and Bernard Sanders' appeal, because they both are appealing to arguments. They seem to be receptive arguments against the establishment.
Well, I think I am a little bit against the establishment, and he probably is also. I tell you, the one thing we have in common is trade. The only difference is he can't do anything about it. I can. He knows that China's ripping us, and he admits it, and he knows Japan and Vietnam, that's the new one on the block, by the way, they're ripping us big league in Mexico, and I do too. The difference is I can do something about it. I will take those deals and make them
great. It's
great
to have you here.
Yes, yeah. Thank you,
Donald. It's nice to be with you, Charlie.
Yes. We hope
nice
that you'll return.
Yes, come back, please.
I will. I will. I'd love to do it by phone. I mean, if you're
your
phoners.
No.
How about some phoners?
It's good to see you in person.
Charlie, it's great to hear you.
We want you to get dressed and out of your pajamas and come.
I'll be back.
We'll see you at the debate on Saturday night.
Good.
As well.
I look forward to it.
All right. That was a comment of President-elect Donald Trump about the situation in the Middle East and what America involvement or any other country involvement is doing to the mess. Well, let's give it the credit that it's due. We are going to honor Mr. Trump's position. But I want to start with a new idea now. Let's think about what's going on in with Assad regime. Assad regime is about to keep his power, is gaining momentum, and is going to give some kind of an exit strategy to their rebels. Now, we don't know about those rebels that disappear. We don't know about those rebels that get killed. And we don't know what a kind of safe passage do they have. The idea is right now is to stop the killing, period. Killing innocent, killing rebels, killing any opposition will be actually a determination to the fact that if Assad will stay or not. The idea that Israel is non-party to all of this is not real, because once you have Hezbollah, Iran playing a part in Assad regime, it's going to influence the reaction that Israel is going to have, and it's going to influence the resistance that people will have against Assad, and Assad might lose his power to stay. The deal is like this, guys. Russia needs to come to the table with America to determine the way that Assad regime is going to hold power in order for them to control the country while authorizing safe passage, helping people to leave the country and to flee to other nations if they can, and to get a sustained medical care to all the people wounded in the middle of this war. We need to make sure that there will be a safe passage, a non-fly zone area where all the evacuated will be safe, regarded by United Nations or any other international group of Red Cross, that will prevent them from getting attacked. And Assad regime need to stay put and get a hold of his own organization. Now, having said that, once Assad regime is staying in power and the Iranians are in play, there will not be any deals. any deals with Assad that will keep on, it will keep on Iran negotiation, or a player in the mix will be avoided and null, because that will be a retraction of the Iran sanction deal that they are not supposed to mitigate any kind of arsenal working in a different countries too. If it's not clear, let's reiterate it. Any movement toward Hezbollah and Iran from the Assad regime will be a consequence of a loss of power, and Russia needs to be sure about that. Russia cannot play that role of working with Assad, Iran, and Hezbollah. If she wants to be a negotiator or a power broker, she needs to stay cool on that. Talking about the American position there, they'll need to create a safe passage for all the people who are fleeing. Everybody who leaves that country needs to have a safe zone where they can go to. Children, people, elderly, wounded. We need to have United Nations evacuation team and supply team and Red Cross playing along right now. We cannot let this war keep on going on forever. Having said that, in case Assad is going to play dirty bombs, dirty playing, killing anybody, his time will be off, and that's it. The American will have to have him play, and the Russian will have nothing to say about that, because this deal cannot be on both sides. You need to take it, and that's it. And that will be the best deal you can ever get, because for Assad to be still in power after all what happened, it's purely by chance. And the only thing that he can keep in mind is that he must redeem himself. If he doesn't redeem himself, you know, before God Almighty, it's his business. But the people of the land, the people around, need to have a leader that, or forget leader, a man that can keep the house safe or their life safe. Enough with the killing. That's as far as Syria goes. Syria is not a safe zone for anybody, and Turks, they better stay out of that mess. It means that all this painful attack that Turkey is suffering these days, it's because of our involvement with the Kurds. The Kurds are a situation that the world has to come to grasp with, and it's about time that Turkey will know what his position. I'm not talking about all those situation and story that the Turks don't want and don't feel comfortable dealing with, but Kurds are part of the Pashtuns in Iraq, and they're part of Turks, and it's going to be time before they get organized. I'm sure that they need to start having an election set up for a new elected government so they can start situating themselves, because by all means, it's enough time, 30 million people to be pushed around or bombed their life away every time somebody get upset with them. That's as far as the Turks goes, and the Kurds, Syria, Iran, Hezbollah, Lebanon. Lebanon was really, really close to get involved in that, and thank God she kept her nose down. Jordan is not in play right now. The only play that she can have is provide food, shelter to all the refugees. And it's a must. You need to do that, because that's your position in the Middle East right now, and you have so much to thank for, especially to your incredible land that was given away to, you know, in 1923 to the Jewish people from the Turk and Ottoman, and you guys decided, Saudi decided, that they can take a chunk. So the Jordanian, if they like it or not, they have a responsibility to give back to their people. And of course, with the cordiality of the Saudis. Now, the Saudis will be very upset if Assad is staying in power because they wanted him to go. It's not easy to say no to the Saudis, but it's not easy to see it differently right now. So the only way that you can have any kind of influence is by doing holy work, saving lives. Sometimes it's your turn. And by saying that, let's get some music here and we'll be back after that. Right, that was Missing You Like the Desert, Mr. Rain. Okay, let's keep on going on Syria and the Russian position right now because they are instrumental in this balance of power. Let's listen to them.
This is the historic quarter of Aleppo City. For over 4 years, it was a front line. The Syrian government and its allies are now in control. The rebels have been losing territory in their last urban stronghold in Syria. Pro-government forces are on the verge of a total military victory. But inside these besieged neighborhoods are civilians caught in a war zone. They are appealing for help.
This is liberated Aleppo. This is destroyed Aleppo. We are being killed. Where are you, Muslims? We are here and we are remaining steadfast. But where are you? Aleppo is being destroyed.
Estimates vary on how many people are trapped, but the number is believed to exceed 100,000. Tens of thousands fled into government-controlled districts when the offensive began almost 2 weeks ago. And as front lines continue to change, more and more find themselves on the other side as government forces push deeper into what is left of rebel areas. Opposition activists say many civilians are being killed in the bombardments, and many are running out of food, clean water, and medicine. But the world is not seeing those images.
The main difficulty we are facing in our job is to show the world the suffering of the civilians inside Aleppo. The world is not seeing the whole picture. Internet is now patchy because the regime took control of the communication towers. So the activists inside besieged areas aren't able to send videos, and their priority now is to stay safe and protect their families.
From across the border in Turkey, citizen journalists like Osama Hadba do their best to stay connected with their colleagues inside Syria, who in turn reflect the feelings among those whose voices are not being heard.
Russia is demanding that fighters leave Aleppo before there is a ceasefire. How can the fighters leave the people unprotected? This means the government and the Iranian militias will take over the area. Civilians don't want to live under the regime, not after all the years of sacrifices and martyrs.
The rebels are refusing the demand by the Syrian and Russian governments to withdraw and instead are calling for a temporary truce to allow the evacuation of civilians.
The latest statements by the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad are uncompromising. It was a victory speech, promising that the decision to, quote, liberate the whole of Syria, including Aleppo, has been taken. Diplomatic efforts seem to be going nowhere. The United States and Russia have been holding talks on the terms for evacuations from besieged areas. But the United Nations says they are poles apart.
It is on the ground where negotiations are playing out, and the rebels' bargaining power, just like their territory, is shrinking. Zena Khadr, Al Jazeera, Southern Turkey.
All right. We're going to wait and see if we can listen to some news from the F-35 that's coming to play. You know, there are a few things that happened there on the F-35 that we will listen to them soon. But what we want to say about the Russian and Aleppo right now, it's still the same game. We need to safeguard those rebels, give them an exit strategy, let them go, and save the day by keeping the rest of the population and start rebuilding Syria. If not, if they're going to drag it for a little more, it's going to be devastating for everybody. So let's keep on going. We have a story about the F-35 that are going about to land in Israel. There is some rumors about what kind of plane is it and if it's a lemon, but for some other people they even call it a turkey. I think that whatever it is, Trump tweet about it that Lockheed Martin F-35 fighter jet cost was too much. Well, everybody know that, but the question is, what are we going to do about it? Let's see if we can hear that part.
Years behind schedule and not without some controversy, America's fifth generation fighter jet represents the future of stealth aircrafts. Welcome to WatchMojo's Top 5 Facts. In today's installment, we're counting down the 5 most interesting things we could learn about the Lockheed Martin F-35 Lightning II, the brand new superjet.
We're probably already working on it.
Number 5. F-35 helmets allow pilots to see through the plane. Visibility has always been a challenge in fighter jets.
I lost him. I'm looking!
Previous generations of planes have sometimes had multiple screens showing real-time imagery from 4 different directions. But the custom-fitted $400,000 F-35 helmet shows real-time imagery from infrared cameras all around the plane in a seamless augmented reality display, effectively allowing the pilots to see right through their own plane. The display also shows them targeting information and interfaces with the communications system. Congratulations, military. You're one step closer to being Iron Man.
Gauge heads-up display.
Check.
Forgo preferences from home interface.
Will do, sir.
Number 4. The F-35 is the most versatile fighter jet ever built. In 2001, the prototype of the F-35, the X-35, was named as the victor of the Joint Strike Fighter Competition, which was created to find a replacement to multiple aircraft, including the F-16 fighter, the low-altitude ground support A-10, and vertical takeoff-enabled Harrier jets. As such, it's sort of a Swiss Army knife for multiple branches of the US military. It's designed to perform bombing missions, support ground troops, and perform well in dogfights. In theory, the F-35's versatility should change the rules of modern combat. But critics, like defense analyst Pierre Spray, are skeptical of this jack-of-all-trades concept. Spray argues that the technical requirements of each role are so inherently different that trying to design one plane to meet them all will only result in an expensive, mediocre flying lemon.
So what is it good at?
It's not good at anything.
What about
it's a turkey.
Those critics might be right, but unfortunately, as civilians, we don't have access to the full range of test flight results, so we won't know for some time.
That's classified.
It's what?
It's classified. I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
Number 3. The F-35 Lightning II is expensive. Spray's at least right about that part. You know a plane is going to break the bank when even the helmet costs $400,000. But for the craft itself, for the actual F-35, the price depends on the desired model. The conventional F-35 for Air Force purposes will cost $98 million. That's called the F-35A. The B version is capable of short takeoff and vertical landing and goes for $104 million. Finally, the carrier-based F-35 is valued at $116 million, a little more due to something called lift system, which allows for vertical takeoffs. This is a huge plus when being deployed from a carrier vessel. Compare these prices to the F-16, which these jets are designed to replace. According to Time magazine, the Pentagon stopped buying F-16s in 1995 and paid an average of only $17 million each. Number 2. The F-35 program is global. Well, I guess one result of all that spending is that a lot of people get paid. The plane's official website, yep, weapons have websites, claims that it creates or supports jobs for nearly 150,000 people in 45 different states and Puerto Rico. In fact, 9 international partners initially banded together for heightened global security. The United States, Canada, Australia, Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and Italy, which is home to one of the two final assembly and checkout facilities beyond US borders. The other is located in Japan. Rather than seeing this international, multi-state involvement as a positive thing, some critics of the project say that spreading out the workload is just Lockheed Martin's way of making sure that it will never get cancelled. Which is a legit concern because... Number 1. The F-35 program is behind schedule and over budget. Despite the international cooperation and the mind-boggling technology of the F-35 program, the fact remains that it's still years behind schedule and wildly over the original budget, as in $163 billion over budget.
The F-35's program's record of performance has been both a scandal and a tragedy with respect to cost, schedule, and performance.
Congress was not happy. The original delivery date for 1,013 F-35s was 2016. Less than 200 had been delivered as of April 2016.
With costs skyrocketing for a plane that has been plagued with troubles after troubles.
Some have charged that Lockheed Martin's system of concurrent flight testing and production is a recipe for expensive retrofits.
Design flaws, including to its engine, caused expensive retrofits and lengthy delays.
A 2016 Government Accountability Office report noted that defects in the plane's computer brain could mean increased costs of up to $100 billion more, pushing the entire project to $500 billion. Perhaps that's just the cost of security? What do you think? Will the F-35 improve global security, or is it just a massive, expensive boondoggle? For more Jack of All Trades Top 10s and Master of None Top 5s, be sure to subscribe to WatchMojo.com.
All right. It's Orly Benny Davis with Impossible Truth. We are talking about the F-35, a very complicated issue in America. Overbudgeted plane, but it's something special. And why it's special? It's because it's 15.7 meters. Its height is 4.33 meters. The best, the velocity is 1,900 kilometers per hour. Even that you don't calculate it in aeronautic numbers. They don't have it here, so I cannot even translate it to you. The range is 2,200 kilometer without refueling, which gives you some sense of from Israel to where you can arrive without fueling. Then we have incredible stealth capacity. You can see through the helmet, the back of the plane and also the floor of the plane, you can see through the helmet. Then you can give orders by voice orders in the cockpit. Then you can follow a few targets at the same time on the GPS, I guess. Of course, you can fuel on top in the air. Then we have an incredible helmet that, what was the cost? $700,000, I guess, for that. That can let the pilot attack without even indicating the target. Then you have the cockpit that has all digitals on the screen of 20 by 50. Of course, you have the ejected seat of Martin Baker. Then you have a design of the plane that has special steels product, titanium, aluminium, and a cover that has a different color that help to not being detected. Which probably it's flashing and it won't be seeing in the air. Then you have an engine of Anden Whitney with bombs, intelligence bomb and missile that are put that are located there. Then you have GPS, of course, that lets you follow up on target at the same time, simultaneously far and low. Then you have a very good list of anti-missiles detection instrument. And then you can have sensory, optical sensors. You can have a communication procedure, and then you have a communication with other planes in the area, and also a navigational company, the various companies. So we have a player that is humongous. It's fantastic. I want to bless America for that, for giving an edge, incredible edge for the Israeli forces. I want to tell our friends in the area that we are a responsible country, state, that will handle everything with gentleness and care. Our pilots are the best, as you all know, and we are trained by the American, which are the best of the best. So here in America has another place where they can lay their head down and relax and have some fun. And maybe if this war will start going away, we can start planning to do some incredible innovation in science, in space, and maybe produce some better aircraft for the next future. Because, as you all know, our first incredible astronaut died, and God bless his soul, a hero, a true hero. And maybe this is will be a start of a new day where we can all know that, you know, nobody can win. It's going to be or complete destruction, or we're going to have to sing Kumbaya together. And I like that idea very much. So let's see if, let's hear if we have another song for you. And we'll be back after that. All right, we are back. This is Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. Now, I've got a great, great piece to let you listen to because it's one of the great men that I had the honor to meet, Senator, former Senator Jim DeMint, who is the head of the Heritage Foundation right now. And he's actually instrumental in helping the new elected President Donald Trump to make a list of the outstanding people that America has, and with all the incredible information that the Heritage Foundation gathered to analyze the situation, he's the man in charge of so many important things, and I'm so happy to have a segment on him. Let's listen.
Every top of his list of priorities is this man, former Senator Jim DeMint, former Republican from Senator from South Carolina, president of the Heritage Foundation. How are you, sir? And welcome back here to America's newsroom. I know you're hoping for a Merry Christmas. You'll get it if you get tax reform across the board, which I know is your number one priority.
Well, there are a lot of priorities, Bill.
Here's the question, though. Do you believe Mr. Trump will deliver on that promise? Well, I believe he definitely intends to. He'll have a battle in Congress. There's a lot of political pressure to keep the tax code complex. A lot of big players here in Washington like all the loopholes. And so it'll be a fight, but I think America's ready for it. We've been working on tax reform ideas for a number of years here at Heritage, and we think there are a number of people in the House and the Senate across America. We're ready for us to get rid of this stupid tax code. It really does cost us jobs. It makes it hard for us to trade with other countries without losing because our companies are paying so much more in taxes.
All right. Mike Pence was at your event last night. And part he said the following. Just listen here.
The focus of this administration ultimately is going to be about, it's ultimately going to be about growth. The first 100 days, I was visiting Capitol Hill the other day, and I told my former colleagues there to buckle up. Vacation's over. We're going to work.
I don't know if a lot of folks at Heritage were on the Trump train early. Were they?
Well, that's not what we do at Heritage, Bill. I mean, we provide resources. We provide people, expertise, policy ideas, research. Anyone who wants to use those, and over 10 of the presidential candidates on the Republican side were in for briefings, and we've been working on transition for over a year, collecting the names of good people all over the country for every position. We've been developing policy manuals, what the administration needs to do to get rid of regulations. Mm-hmm. So we've been working a long time to get ready, but it's not about endorsing a person. It's about the ideas that will make this country great again.
Okay, more on the transition in a moment. But if you were to get your wish list, what would that look mm-hmm. like, Senator?
Well, very quickly, we want to repeal Obamacare so we can begin the process of replacing it with patient-centered, free-market health care. We need to fund the border fence so that we can stop this uncontrolled immigration coming into our country right now and get back to a legal system that works for our country. The next thing would be a good Supreme Court nominee, which we've had a chance to work on with the president-elect. And then we move on to taking down the regulations, executive orders, and then to tax reform. So okay. That's my Christmas wish list.
All right. Well, we'll see how good Santa's going to be to you in January of 2017. You mentioned the transition, sir. New York Magazine has this headline. I just want your reaction. Remember Jim DeMint? His fingerprints are all over the Trump transition. Guilty as charged? Is that true?
Well, no. Well, it's a mistake to think we're directing anything or have any authority. As I said before, we want to be a resource, but the reason that we're being used so much by the Trump team is I think we're the only policy organization that has really been working on this in a serious way for a long time. And we've had volunteers since the convention, since Donald Trump became the nominee, working on ideas and policies and, again, collecting names so that Donald Trump's people can select from a really good list. So I don't want to suggest that we have any authority in this, but we are a big resource, and we're grateful for that.
Okay, last question. If you were to imagine a new economy the way you lay it out, what's GDP? What's growth, realistically?
I think it's realistic to get between 3 and 4%. It may take a while to ramp up to that. But a lot of that is just in the attitude of investors, risk takers out there, which we've already seen some move to the positive side. If people believe we're going to take apart some of these regulations, get Obamacare off their back, change Dodd-Frank, if they believe that the president is really going to try to create a better business environment, they'll start investing right away. So it's my hope within the next couple of years that we will see growth between 3 and 4%.
Yeah, so 2 years is the horizon you see then?
Well, I hope to see it quicker than that, and we very well might. The way things are going now, if regulations, a lot of these executive orders can be taken away in the first day of the presidency, I think you'll see a lot of investment and growth right away.
We will see. Senator, thank you for your time. Merry Christmas to you. Jim DeMint there from the Heritage Group there in Washington. Thank you, sir.
DeMint, Senator Jim DeMint. He been working on this tax, cut for so long. I've been privileged enough to run a campaign with him or against him in the primaries of 2004 of the Republican Party in South Carolina. And Jim DeMint was talking about the tax cut. He was talking about the situation about putting work elsewhere. He knows the issue so well, and he's been a complete gentleman and a kind soul to everybody. And I know that he works hard to do the best for America. And I trust him so much, and we are so blessed to have a man of this caliber taking the issue and trying to put to play all the important points and people that are in the game. What a lucky break we have. So I'm sure that Mr. Jim DeMint still remember me, because I was a tenacious contender, of course. And I know that we all love America so much, so I'm sending him all my best, and I hope that God will do the rest, okay? Now, let's have a song, and after that, we're going to do some motion to pray. All right, we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis. We're almost running out of time, but I want you all to listen to Jerusalem Story. It's little, short, but it's holy, and it's very important for you to remember that there is a God, and it's not us. Let's listen to the facts about the holy city of Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. A historical journey through archaeology and art. Jerusalem, a mosaic of different peoples, faiths, and nationalities. Nevertheless, despite this diversity, under the sovereignty of Israel, Jerusalem is a city that works. But has it always been this way? The first historical mention of Jerusalem is in the Bible, in the era of the patriarchs. King David declares Jerusalem as Israel's capital, known from that point on also as Zion. His son King Solomon builds the first temple. But the temple is destroyed by the Babylonians, and the Jews are exiled. King Cyrus's declaration enables the Jews to return and rebuild the temple. Alexander the Great's conquests include Jerusalem. However, his successors desecrate the temple, which leads to the Maccabees' revolt against the Greeks' imposition of Hellenism. The Roman Empire seizes control, and King Herod renovates the temple. A large-scale revolt against a corrupt and vicious Roman reign fails. The second temple is destroyed, and the Jews are banned from Jerusalem. 60 years pass, and Bar Kokhba leads another revolt for the freedom of Jerusalem. But it fails after 3 years of battle. Jews are banned from the city, renamed by the Romans Aelia Capitolina in order to eradicate its Jewish heritage. Roman Emperor Constantine converts to Christianity and reinforces the ban on Jews entering Jerusalem. A new religion, Islam, sweeps through the Middle East. Non-Muslims are declared second-class citizens. Crusaders conquer Jerusalem in a bloodbath of Jews and Muslims. 2,000 Jews are burned alive in the main synagogue, and the city is depopulated of its previous inhabitants. The first organized mass Jewish return arrives from France and England. The Mamluks defeat the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem, and building and renovating of synagogues and churches is banned. The great Mishnah commentator, Rabbi Ovadia of Bartanura, settles in Jerusalem. The Ottoman Empire takes over, imposing restrictions on Jews and Christians, and Sultan Suleiman rebuilds the walls. But as the empire declines, Jerusalem is badly neglected. Still, the Jewish people stream back, build new neighborhoods, and re-establish their majority by 1863. World War I breaks out. The Ottoman Empire collapses and makes room for a new Middle East. The British Foreign Secretary, Arthur James Balfour, declares the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people. Britain receives a mandate to create a Jewish homeland, but forbids Jews from blowing the shofar or reading holy scrolls at the Western Wall. Thousands of Muslims are incited to unleash an attack against Jews in Jerusalem and Hebron. 86 Jews are brutally murdered, hundreds are wounded. UN Resolution 181 declares Jerusalem as a corpus separatum, a separate entity. A Jewish state is declared as Jerusalem is put under siege, conquered, and divided. 58 synagogues are destroyed or desecrated. Harsh limitations are imposed on Jews and Christians for 19 years. The Six-Day War. Jerusalem is reunited and freedom and equality are restored. Throughout history, only Israel has protected the freedom of all peoples and faiths in Jerusalem.
All right, we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis as we speak. The F-35 are landing down in Israel, where all the groups, the Air Force, are singing Hallelujah. And many thanks and blessings are going to America, our beloved friend, who take care of Israel like nobody else, the big brother, the beloved friend that cares so much to protect the Holy Land, God's land. That's why God loves America, because she cares for the Holy Land. We all in tears, we all excited, we all are incredibly joyful for this amazing, amazing show of force that America showed Israel. I want to send all my love to you guys and to remind you that we are your best friend too, and you can count on us. And in this craziness of the world, Israel and America are united in friendship, in brotherhood of man, and in protecting the innocents and making sure that Israel is secure and America is safe. So let me bless you all, and from Israel, all the best. God bless you all. Ciao, ciao.